Section 5. The Capitalistic Character of Manufacture. An increased number of labourers under the control of one capitalist is the natural starting point, as well as of cooperation generally, as of manufacture in particular. But the division of labour in manufacture makes this increase in the number of workmen a technical necessity. The minimum number that any given capitalist is bound to employ is here prescribed by the previously established division of labour. On the other hand, the advantages of further division are obtainable only by adding to the number of workmen, and this can be done only by adding multiples of the various detail groups. But an increase in the variable component of the capital employed necessitates an increase in its constant component too, in the workshops, implements, etc., and in particular in the raw material, the call for which grows quicker than the number of workmen. The quantity of it consumed in a given time by a given amount of labour increases in the same ratio as does the productive power of that labour in consequence of its division. Hence, it is a law, based on the very nature of manufacture, that the minimum amount of capital, which is bound to be in the hands of each capitalist, must keep increasing. In other words, that the transformation into capital of the social means of production and subsistence must keep extending. Footnote. It is not sufficient that the capital, the writer should have said, the necessary means of subsistence and of production, required for the subdivision of handicrafts should be in readiness in the society. It must also be accumulated in the hands of the employers in sufficiently large quantities to enable them to conduct their operations on a large scale. The more the division increases, the more does the constant employment of a given number of labourers require a greater outlay of capital in tools, raw material, etc. Storch, Cours d'Economie Politique. The concentration of the instruments of production and the division of labour are as inseparable, one from the other, as are in the political sphere the concentration of public powers and the division of private interests. Karl Marx. End of footnote. In manufacture, as well as in simple cooperation, the collective working organism is a form of existence of capital. The mechanism that is made up of numerous individual detail labourers belongs to the capitalist. Hence, the productive power resulting from a combination of labours appears to be the productive power of capital. Manufacture proper not only subjects the previously independent workman to the discipline and command of capital, but, in addition, creates a hierarchic gradation of the workmen themselves. While simple cooperation leaves the mode of working by the individual for the most part unchanged, manufacture thoroughly revolutionizes it and seizes labor power by its very roots. It converts the labourer into a crippled monstrosity by forcing his detailed dexterity at the expense of a world of productive capabilities and instincts. Just as in the states of La Plata they butcher a whole beast for the sake of his hide or his tallow. Not only is the detail work distributed to the different individuals, but the individual himself is made the automatic motor of a fractional operation. Footnote. Dugald Stewart calls manufacturing labourers living automatons employed in the details of the work. End of footnote. And the absurd fable of Menenius Agrippa, which makes man a mere fragment of his own body, becomes realised. Footnote. In corals, each individual is, in fact, the stomach of the whole group, but it supplies the group with nourishment instead of, like the Roman patrician, withdrawing it. End of footnote. If at first the workman sells his labour power to capital because the material means of producing a commodity fail him, now his very labour power refuses its services unless it has been sold to capital. Its functions can be exercised only in an environment that exists in the workshop of the capitalist after the sale. By nature unfitted to make anything independently, the manufacturing labourer develops productive activity as a mere appendage of the capitalist's workshop. Footnote. The worker who is the master of a whole craft can work and find the means of subsistence anywhere. The other, the manufacturing labourer, is only an appendage who, when he is separated from his fellows, possesses neither capability nor independence, and finds himself forced to accept any law it is thought fit to impose. Storch, 1815, end of footnote. As the chosen people bore in their features the sign manual of Jehovah, so division of labour brands the manufacturing workman as the property of capital. The knowledge, the judgment, and the will, which, though in ever so small a degree, are practised by the independent peasant or handicraftsman, in the same way as the savage makes the whole art of war consist in the exercise of his personal cunning, these faculties are now required only for the workshop as a whole. Intelligence in production expands in one direction because it vanishes in many others. What is lost by the detail labourers is concentrated in the capital that employs them. Footnote. A. Ferguson. The former may have gained what the other has lost. End of footnote. It is a result of the division of labour in manufactures that the labourer is brought face to face with the intellectual potencies of the material process of production, as the property of another, and as a ruling power. This separation begins in simple cooperation, where the capitalist represents to the single workman the oneness and the will of the associated labour. It is developed in manufacture, which cuts down the labourer into a detail labourer. It is completed in modern industry, which makes science a productive force distinct from labour and presses it into the service of capital. Footnote. The man of knowledge and the productive labourer come to be widely divided from each other, and knowledge, instead of remaining the handmaid of labour in the hand of the labourer to increase his productive powers, has almost everywhere arrayed itself against labour, systematically deluding and leading them, the labourers, astray in order to render their muscular powers entirely mechanical and obedient. W. Thompson, An Inquiry into the Principles of the Distribution of Wealth, London, 1824. End of footnote. In manufacture, in order to make the collective labourer, and through him, capital, rich in social productive power, each labourer must be made poor in individual productive powers. Ignorance is the mother of industry as well as of superstition. Reflection and fancy are subject to err, but a habit of moving the hand or the foot is independent of either. Manufactures, accordingly, prosper most where the mind is least consulted, and where the workshop may be considered as an engine, the parts of which are men. Footnote. A. Ferguson. End of footnote. As a matter of fact, some few manufacturers in the middle of the 18th century preferred, for certain operations that were trade secrets, to employ half-idiotic persons. Footnote. J.D. Tuckett, A History of the Past and Present State of the Labouring Population, 1846. End of footnote. The understandings of the greater part of men, says Adam Smith, are necessarily formed by their ordinary employments. The man whose whole life is spent in performing a few simple operations has no occasion to exert his understanding. He generally becomes as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become. After describing the stupidity of the detail labourer, he goes on, "The uniformity of his stationary life naturally corrupts the courage of his mind. It corrupts even the activity of his body, and renders him incapable of exerting his strength with vigour and perseverance, in any other employments than that to which he has been bred. His dexterity at his own particular trade seems in this manner to be acquired at the expense of his intellectual, social, and martial virtues. But in every improved and civilized society, this is the state into which the laboring poor, that is, the great body of the people, must necessarily fall. Footnote. A. Smith, Wealth of Nations. Being a pupil of A. Ferguson, who showed the disadvantageous effects of division of labour, Adam Smith was perfectly clear on this point. In the introduction to his work, where he ex professo praises division of labour, he indicates only in a cursory manner that it is the source of social inequalities. It is not till the fifth book, On the Revenue of the State, that he reproduces Ferguson. In my Misère de la Philosophie, I have sufficiently explained the historical connection between Ferguson, A. Smith, Lemontey, and Say, as regards their criticisms of division of labour, and have shown for the first time that division of labour as practised in manufactures is a specific form of the capitalist mode of production. End of footnote. For preventing the complete deterioration of the great mass of the people by division of labour, A. Smith recommends education of the people by the state, but prudently, and in homeopathic doses. G. Garnier, his French translator and commentator, who, under the First French Empire, quite naturally developed into a senator, quite as naturally opposes him on this point. Education of the masses, he urges, violates the first law of the division of labour, and with it our whole social system would be proscribed. Like all other divisions of labour, he says that between hand labour and head labour is more pronounced and decided in proportion as society, he rightly uses this word for capital, landed property and their state, becomes richer. Footnote. Ferguson had already said, and thinking itself in this age of separations may become a peculiar craft. End of footnote. This division of labour, like every other, is an effect of past and a cause of future progress. Ought the government, then, to work in opposition to this division of labour and to hinder its natural course? Ought it to expend a part of the public money in the attempt to confound and blend together two classes of labour which are striving after division and separation? Some crippling of body and mind is inseparable even from division of labour in society as a whole. Since, however, manufacture carries this social separation of branches of labour much further, and also, by its peculiar division, attacks the individual at the very roots of his life, it is the first to afford the materials for, and to give a start to, industrial pathology. Footnote. Ramazzini, professor of practical medicine at Padua, published in 1713 his work De Morbis Artificum, which was translated into French 1781, reprinted 1841, in the Encyclopédie des Sciences Médicales. The period of modern mechanical industry has, of course, very much enlarged his catalogue of labour's diseases. In 1854, the Society of Arts appointed a commission of inquiry into industrial pathology. The list of documents collected by this commission is to be seen in the catalogue of the Twickenham Economic Museum. Very important are the official reports on public health. End of footnote. To subdivide a man is to execute him if he deserves the sentence, to assassinate him if he does not. The subdivision of labour is the assassination of a people. Footnote. D. Urquhart, Familiar Words, 1855. Hegel held very heretical views on division of labour. In his Res Philosophie, he says, by well-educated men we understand, in the first instance, those who can do everything that others do. End of footnote. Cooperation based on division of labour, in other words, manufacture, commences as a spontaneous formation. So soon as it attains some consistence and extension, it becomes the recognised methodical and systematic form of capitalist production. History shows how the division of labour peculiar to manufacture, strictly so called, acquires the best adapted form at first by experience, as it were behind the backs of the actors, and then, like the guild handicrafts, strives to hold fast that form when once found, and here and there succeeds in keeping it for centuries. Any alteration in this form, except in trivial matters, is solely owing to a revolution in the instruments of labour. Modern manufacture, whenever it arises, I do not here allude to modern industry based on machinery, either finds the disjecta membra poetae ready to hand, and only waiting to be collected together, as is the case in the manufacture of clothes in large towns, or it can easily apply the principle of division, simply by exclusively assigning the various operations of a handicraft, such as bookbinding, to particular men. In such cases, a week's experience is enough to determine the proportion between the numbers of the hands necessary for the various functions. Footnote. The simple belief in the inventive genius exercised a priori by the individual capitalist in division of labour exists nowadays only among German professors of the stamp of Herr Rocher, who, to recompense the capitalist from whose Jovian head division of labour sprang ready formed, dedicates to him various wages, diverse Arbeitslöhne. The more or less extensive application of division of labour depends on length of purse, not on greatness of genius. End of footnote. By decomposition of handcrafts, by specialisation of the instruments of labour, by the formation of detail labourers, and by grouping and combining the latter into a single mechanism, division of labour in manufacture creates a qualitative gradation and a quantitative proportion in the social process of production. It consequently creates a definite organisation of the labour of society, and thereby develops at the same time new productive forces in the society. In its specific capitalist form, and under the given conditions, it could take no other form than a capitalistic one. Manufacture is but a particular method of begetting relative surplus value, or of augmenting at the expense of the labourer the self-expansion of capital, usually called social wealth, wealth of nations, etc. It increases the social productive power of labour, not only for the benefit of the capitalist instead of for that of the labourer, but it does this by crippling the individual labourers. It creates new conditions for the lordship of capital over labour. If, therefore, on the one hand, it presents itself historically as a progress and a necessary phase in the economic development of society, on the other hand, it is a refined and civilised method of exploitation. Political economy, which, as an independent science, first sprang into being during the period of manufacture, views the social division of labour only from the standpoint of manufacture, and sees in it only the means of producing more commodities with a given quantity of labour, and consequently of cheapening commodities and hurrying on the accumulation of capital. Footnote. The older writers like Petty and the anonymous author of Advantages of the East India Trade bring out the capitalist character of division of labour as applied in manufacture more than A. Smith does. End of footnote. In most striking contrast with this accentuation of quantity and exchange value is the attitude of the writers of classical antiquity, who hold exclusively by quality and use value. Footnote. Amongst the moderns may be excepted a few writers of the 18th century, like Beccaria and James Harris, who with regard to division of labour almost entirely follow the ancients. Thus Beccaria: "Everyone knows from experience that if the hands and the intelligence are always applied to the same kind of work and the same products, these will be produced more easily, in greater abundance, and in higher quality, than if each individual makes for himself all the things he needs. In this way, men are divided up into various classes and conditions, to their own advantage and to that of the commodity." James Harris, afterwards Earl of Malmesbury, celebrated for the diaries of his embassy at St. Petersburg, says in a note to his Dialogue Concerning Happiness, 1741, reprinted afterwards in Three Treatises, 1772, "The whole argument to prove society natural, that is, by division of employments, is taken from the second book of Plato's Republic." End of footnote. In consequence of the separation of the social branches of production, commodities are better made, the various bents and talents of men select a suitable field. Footnote. Thus in the Odyssey, "For different men take joy in different works, and Archilochus in Sextus Empiricus, men differ as to things cheer their hearts." End of footnote. "And without some restraint, no important results can be obtained anywhere." Footnote. "He could do many works, but all of them badly." Homer. "Every Athenian considered himself superior as a producer of commodities to a Spartan, for the latter in time of war had men enough at his disposal, but could not command money." As Thucydides makes Pericles say in the speech inciting the Athenians to the Peloponnesian War, "People producing for their own consumption will rather let war have their bodies than their money." Nevertheless, even with regard to material production, self-sufficiency, as opposed to division of labour, remained their ideal. For with the latter there is well-being, but with the former there is independence. It should be mentioned here that at the date of the fall of the 30 tyrants, there were still not 5,000 Athenians without landed property. End of footnote. Hence both product and producer are improved by division of labour. If the growth of the quantity produced is occasionally mentioned, this is only done with reference to the greater abundance of use values. There is not a word alluding to exchange value or to the cheapening of commodities. This aspect, from the standpoint of use value alone, is taken as well by Plato, who treats division of labour as the foundation on which the division of society into classes is based, as by Xenophon, who with characteristic bourgeois instinct approaches more nearly to division of labour within the workshop. Footnote. With Plato, division of labour within the community is a development from the multifarious requirements and the limited capacities of individuals. The main point with him is that the labourer must adapt himself to the work, not the work to the labourer, which latter is unavoidable if he carries on several trades at once, thus making one or the other of them subordinate. For the workman must wait upon the work, it will not wait upon his leisure and allow itself to be done in a spare moment. Yes, he must. So the conclusion is that more will be produced of everything, and the work will be more easily and better done when every man is set free from all other occupations to do at the right time the one thing for which he is naturally fitted. So in Thucydides, "Seafaring is an art like any other, and cannot, as circumstances require, be carried on as a subsidiary occupation. Nay, other subsidiary occupations cannot be carried on alongside of this one." If the work, says Plato, has to wait for the labourer, the critical point in the process is missed and the article spoiled. If someone lets slip... The same Platonic idea is found recurring in the protest of the English bleachers against the clause in the Factory Act that provides fixed meal times for all operatives. Their business cannot wait the convenience of the workmen, for, in the various operations of singeing, washing, bleaching, mangling, calendaring, and dyeing, none of them can be stopped at a given moment without risk of damage. To enforce the same dinner hour for all the workpeople might occasionally subject valuable goods to the risk of danger by incomplete operations. Where will Platonism be found next? Xenophon says, "It is not only an honour to receive food from the table of the king of Persia, but such food is much more tasty than other food. And there is nothing wonderful in this, for as the other arts are brought to special perfection in the great towns, so the royal food is prepared in a special way. For in the small towns the same man makes bedsteads, doors, ploughs, and tables. Often, too, he builds houses into the bargain, and is quite content if he finds custom sufficient for his sustenance. It is altogether impossible for a man who does so many things to do them all well. But in the great towns, where each can find many buyers, one trade is sufficient to maintain the man who carries it on. Nay, there is often not even need of one complete trade, but one man makes shoes for men, another for women. Here and there, one man gets a living by sewing, another by cutting out shoes. One does nothing but cut out clothes, another nothing but sew the pieces together. It follows necessarily, then, that he who does the simplest kind of work undoubtedly does it better than anyone else. So it is with the art of cooking." Xenophon here lays stress exclusively upon the excellence to be attained in use value, although he well knows that the gradations of the division of labour depend on the extent of the market. End of footnote. Plato's Republic, in so far as division of labour is treated in it, as the formative principle of the state, is merely the Athenian idealization of the Egyptian system of castes, Egypt having served as the model of an industrial country to many of his contemporaries also, amongst others to Isocrates, and it continued to have this importance to the Greeks of the Roman Empire. Footnote. Busiris divided them all into special castes, commanded that the same individuals should always carry on the same trade, for he knew that they who change their occupations become skilled in none, but that those who constantly stick to one occupation bring it to the highest perfection. In truth, we shall also find that in relation to the arts and handicrafts, they have outstripped their rivals more than a master does a bungler, and the contrivances for maintaining the monarchy and the other institutions of their state are so admirable that the most celebrated philosophers who treat of this subject praise the constitution of the Egyptian state above all others. End of footnote. During the manufacturing period proper, that is, the period during which manufacture is the predominant form taken by capitalist production, many obstacles are opposed to the full development of the peculiar tendencies of manufacture. Although manufacture creates, as we have already seen, a simple separation of the labourers into skilled and unskilled, simultaneously with their hierarchic arrangement in classes, yet the number of the unskilled labourers, owing to the preponderating influence of the skilled, remains very limited. Although it adapts the detail operations to the various degrees of maturity, strength, and development of the living instruments of labour, thus conducing to exploitation of women and children, yet this tendency as a whole is wrecked on the habits and the resistance of the male labourers. Although the splitting up of handicrafts lowers the cost of forming the workman, and thereby lowers his value, yet for the more difficult detail work a longer apprenticeship is necessary, and even where it would be superfluous is jealously insisted upon by the workman. In England, for instance, we find the laws of apprenticeship, with their 7 years probation, in full force down to the end of the manufacturing period, and they are not thrown on one side till the advent of modern industry. Since handicraft skill is the foundation of manufacture, and since the mechanism of manufacture as a whole possesses no framework apart from the labourers themselves, capital is constantly compelled to wrestle with the insubordination of the workmen. By the infirmity of human nature, says friend Ewer, it happens that the more skilful the workman, the more self-willed and intractable he is apt to become, and of course the less fit a component of a mechanical system in which he may do great damage to the whole. Hence, throughout the whole manufacturing period, there runs the complaint of want of discipline among the workmen. Footnote. This is more the case in England than in France, and more in France than in Holland. End of footnote. And had we not the testimony of contemporary writers, the simple facts that during the period between the 16th century and the epoch of modern industry, capital failed to become the master of the whole disposable working time of the manufacturing labourers, that manufactures are short-lived and change their locality from one country to another with the emigrating or immigrating workmen, these facts would speak volumes. "Order must in one way or another be established," exclaims in 1770 the oft-cited author of the Essay on Trade and Commerce. "Order," re-echoes Dr. Andrew Ewer 66 years later, "order was wanting in manufacture based on the scholastic dogma of division of labour, and Arkwright created order." At the same time, manufacture was unable either to seize upon the production of society to its full extent, or to revolutionise that production to its very core. It towered up as an economic work of art, on the broad foundation of the town handicrafts and of the rural domestic industries. At a given stage in its development, the narrow technical basis on which manufacture rested came into conflict with requirements of production that were created by manufacture itself. One of its most finished creations was the workshop for the production of the instruments of labour themselves, including especially the complicated mechanical apparatus then already employed. "A machine factory," says Ewer, "displayed the division of labour in manifold gradations, the file, the drill, the lathe, having each its different workmen, in the order of skill. This workshop, the production of the division of labour in manufacture, produced in its turn machines. It is they that sweep away the handicraftsman's work as the regulating principle of social production. Thus, on the one hand, the technical reason for the lifelong annexation of the workman to a detail function is removed. On the other hand, the fetters that this same principle laid on the dominion of capital fall away."